Agriculture and Natural Resource to order. HJM 28 is going to be held over until Friday. Is there anybody here that drove up to testify on it? We did put out a sign-up sheet, but I just want to make sure we could go ahead and open a public hearing if we needed to on that. Otherwise, it'll be scheduled for Friday. Okay, seeing none. We have HCR 10. I'll open a public hearing on HCR 10. And Patrick, do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, yes, Madam Chair. HCR 10 is a memorial in honor of former State Representative L.L. Stubbs Stewart. It was brought to us by Representative Bruce Hanna and Senator Ted Ferrioli. And, of course, as a memorial, there is no fiscal revenue impact for the measure.
Thank you very much. It's nice to see so many people here, and it's nice to honor a great gentleman. I don't see Senator Ferrioli in the room, but I see Representative Hanna. Would you like to come forward? And also, I'd like to recognize Jennifer Solomon if she's in the... Is she here? Oh, hi. And this is... Do you want to just stand up for a minute and let everybody... This is the daughter, the man we are honoring, and she was fortunate enough to come here today. Thank you very much. Granddaughter.
Thank you.
I need my glass. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Representative Hanna.
Good morning, colleagues. Madam Chair, thank you for hearing us this morning. Committee members, we appreciate you taking time to hear testimony on HCR 10, the Stubbs Stewart Memorial. As the chief co-sponsor, we'd also like to note that every legislative member from both Lane and Douglas counties signed on as co-sponsors, in addition to the Senator Ferrioli, who worked for Stubbs Stewart for a number of years. The memorial is an honor to an Oregon icon. Stubbs Stewart was one of Oregon's most dedicated and distinguished citizens. He was born in Cottage Grove and graduated from high school there. He earned a degree in logging engineering from Oregon Agricultural College, now OSU. Stubbs served his country in World War II and later became a giant in the Oregon timber business. He followed that with a belief that private success brought the obligation for public service. And the list of his services are many. My testimony could include much of Stubbs' accomplishments. However, there are a number of distinguished guests with us here today that can do a much better job than I in that, and I am pleased that they are here to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative? Thank you. I think we'll start by calling Dave Frohnmayer. Do you want people to come up separately or together, or good morning? Okay, that'd be great. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be among a very large group of people who want to pay tribute to the life of Stubbs Stewart and to his legacy in the state of Oregon. And because of this large number of people, my remarks will be brief, but they are nonetheless heartfelt. For the record, I'm Dave Frohnmayer, currently president of the University of Oregon, a longtime resident of Lane County, and a friend through my life of Stubbs Stewart. Mr. Stewart was tireless in his pursuit for a better Oregon. He was, in the best sense, bipartisan in his efforts. He had a life devoted to community service, and his landmarks are many. Some of them are well known. His service in this legislative assembly, which was service with great distinction in the 1950s. I had the great pleasure of having as my floor secretary when I served in this house in the 70s, a person who had served with Mr. Stewart. Her stories were legendary because she was speaking of a legendary man. And certainly I benefited by virtue of the experience that he had accumulated and that was relayed through this wonderful network that constitutes service to the Oregon House of Representatives. What's not generally known are some of his contributions, which are really quite outstanding. Preserving the pristine nature of Odell Lake. He is this person who surveyed the Clear Lake cutoff, by which residents of the Willamette Valley are able much more easily now to travel to Central Oregon, a country that was volcanic and deemed to be nearly impassable, but which he quite literally traversed on foot in order to make sure that better roads were built there. He served on the State Board of Higher Education in the 1970s, named by Governor Tom McCall at a time of great crisis and civil disturbance and unrest in this whole nation. And he served with great distinction as a voice for higher education and as a voice for reason and calm when hotter heads might have done greater damage to higher education itself. Mr. Stewart was extraordinary in his personal generosity, as I think everyone who is even remotely familiar with him knows. Although he was a graduate of Oregon State University, he was also a benefactor of the University of Oregon, including student scholarships and assistance in endowed professorship in law and entrepreneurship. He was a winner of the University of Oregon's highest award to its citizens, the University of Oregon Pioneer Award. And that's simply exemplary of the many, many awards and achievements that have been recognized through his lifetime. He lived into his 90s. He lived a full and robust life. He was, in some senses, although his name was Stubb, really larger than life, a person of great stature and vision, willing to take unpopular positions and willing very doggedly to see them through if he believed them to be in the public interest. There's much more to be said, Madam Chair, members of the committee, but that will be said by many distinguished people who follow me. I do thank you for your courtesy and urge the passage of this measure.
Thank you, Mr. Fromler. Thank you very much. Tom Hoyt. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Hoyt. I am pleased to call myself a friend and sidekick of Stubb Stewart's. And I've known him for about 50 years and had a chance to travel the great state of Oregon with him a number of times. And we always made a joke that he knew every tree by its first name. And I just want to commend to you the fact that this man was a tremendous visionary and he knew how to get things done. And you'll hear later about the flag that he put on Skinner's Butte and how he helped preserve the white sands beaches for all the citizens of Oregon. And he knew how to get from point A to point B, and he would just doggedly pursue it until he got there. He left us a great legacy of public ownership of the beaches, and he was just truly an Oregonian in every sense of the word. And it's a pleasure to come here and ask you to esteem his memory, and I remember the one thing he always told me is, Tom, you never learned anything with your mouth open, so I better sit down and say, God bless Stubb Stewart. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Ward Armstrong. That's good. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ward Armstrong, and it's a pleasure to be here today to speak in behalf of this resolution. You know, we're all going to be, if we're not careful, terribly repetitive. So I will try to kind of skip over some of what I have said here. The contribution partly that I can make is Stubb was quite a leader in the forest products industry. He was a founder with his brother and his brother-in-law of Bohemia Lumber Company. He was a member for and the first chairman of the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Oregon. He held national positions representing the forest products industry when he was actively engaged with his business. But throughout his career, his vision was much broader than that. You'll hear in a few minutes, I'm sure, about his role with the Forest Research Lab at Oregon State University. His vision and philanthropy have already been referred to, and in fact, that would just be repetitive. I think one thing that I would like to kind of close with is Stubb's involvement in the political process, which literally did not end, I think, until weeks before he died. He would come to Salem regularly, meet with political leaders of both parties, and it wasn't very long before his death, maybe a year or two, that he was circulating a letter to solve Oregon's tax problems that he continued to work on clear to the end. You know, Stubb often talked to me about the time when he was in the legislature, the three sessions that he served here. And he would remark that, why can't the legislature today be more bipartisan like we were? Now, I think there's a little selective memory there. But that was Stubb. And finally, I would have to conclude in the same way that Stubb is watching, I'm sure, to be sure that we're all brief. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. George Brown, Green State Forestry. Hello and welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm George Brown, Dean Emeritus of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University and Director Emeritus of the Forest Research Laboratory, and I'm here to testify on behalf of HCR 10. Now, the text of your resolution contains some very general statements about Stubb's leadership, his public service, and his philanthropy. And let me give you a couple of details that you might not know about. Stubb served as chair of the Forest Research Laboratory's Advisory Committee. This is a statutory committee. And he served in that capacity for 25 years. Now, the normal tenure for membership on that committee is 6 years, but my predecessor and I both believe that his leadership was so key to the success of the laboratory that we asked him to continue to serve, and he did that. And the reason, of course, was, as Ward Armstrong said, he was a leader in the industry, and he really was well connected with that industry. And beyond that, he had this uncanny ability, I think, to perceive the future knowledge needs that our forest managers and our mill managers were going to need in the up in the future to make sure that management of our forests and our mills went smoothly. And that's critical for conducting a research program, that vision in the future, and to make sure that our programs were both timely and relevant. He did a superb job for us, and I think he played a major role in helping us to become one of the premier forest research organizations in the United States. President Frohnmayer alluded to the philanthropy that Stubb provided for a very broad spectrum of higher education programs and universities here in Oregon. That was not just forestry, and it was not just Oregon State University, his alma mater, as President Frohnmayer said. At OSU, let me give you some example of the kinds of gifts. He and his brother helped construct the LaSalle Stewart Center that provided space for our performing arts auditorium and for conferences and workshops. He provided scholarships across the board to students, both undergraduate and graduate students, throughout the university. Provided funds for faculty development, which is absolutely critical to keep a university's faculty up to date and progressive. He supported the sciences in addition to forestry, and that included things like the Center for Gene Research and Biotechnology. Now, during my 10 years as Dean of the College of Forestry, I opened each school year with our new forestry students and provided a lecture about professional ethics and about professionalism. And I told these young students that professionals contribute not only to the organizations for which they work and to their profession, but to their communities as well. Stubb Stewart was the person whom I used as a model for this kind of ideal professional. I'm proud to say that Stubb Stewart was my mentor, he was my friend, and especially that he was an alum of our College of Forestry at Oregon State University, and I'm also very proud to support House Concurrent Resolution Number 10. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mike Soley? Did I say that correct? No.
Close.
You'll be close. You'll say it correctly.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the time to speak. My name is Mike Taley, and currently I'm the publisher of the weekly newspapers in Junction City and Vinita. But in another life, in the mid-90s, I spent 4 years with great pleasure doing a book that would be titled Bohemia and published by the Oregon Historical Society. It's the story of Oregon's Bohemia Lumber Company and its cornerstone, the family of Stubb Stewart and Stubb himself. Once a week, for a year and a half, I got to sit down with Stubb Stewart for an interview of an hour or so. And from a long career in journalism, I thought I understood this state. But what did I know? This weekly sit-down was like going to grad school in the business of life. And through Stubb, I saw an Oregon that I had never known because his linkage with this state was so incredible. He made me see complexities in working relationships and political dynamics that I could not have imagined. And no life was more complex or more dynamic than his, even into his ninth decade. In his final illness, he was wheeling and dealing from his hospital bed, creating a new charitable foundation. In his time, he was a hard-driving CEO, a savvy legislator who almost became Speaker of the House, an adventurer who ran most of the West's whitewater rivers, a confidant and advisor to state leaders of both political parties, a consummate storyteller, and a quiet philanthropist. You will hear and have heard much about how the things he did affected Oregon and its people. For my part, I would take just a few minutes to talk about the mark he left on Oregon geography. The Clear Lake Cutoff. When he was a very young Forest Service surveyor, his elders expressed great frustration about their inability to come up with a link between the McKenzie Highway and the Santiam Highway. For years they had sent surveyors into that geography and they'd come back frustrated. Stubb spent months in the High Cascades, and his survey notes that are now 70 years old recount his travels on foot. He heads north from the McKenzie Highway, and he holds to the west shoulder of the Cascades, and he pokes around in the lava fields, and he boondocks past Scott Creek and Olali Flats and Sweetwater Creek, and finally he hits the Santiam, and he comes back and tells a friend of his that he thinks someday this road will be really something. And now, of course, it's the link for so many of us from the valley with Central Oregon. 30 years later, in the 60s, it appeared that hotel owners and developers were going to be able to fence off Oregon's beaches. But the old Forest Service surveyor, who by then was a veteran on the State Parks Advisory Committee, remembered the legal principle that said that if a piece of land had been in public use for a long time, the public's right to use it was guaranteed. And so Stubb sent researchers to proving that the beaches had been in public use since pioneer days as a coastal road. And the concept was wrapped into the Oregon Beach Bill, and each time that Attorney General Lee Johnson used it to defend threats to that action, he would call the old surveyor and thank him for that principle. Stubb left his mark, too, on the geography of Eugene, where there's a huge veterans memorial and flag waving over the city from Skinner Butte. To do this, at the age of 88, he took on a phalanx of opponents and by sheer force of will created this memorial to veterans. And in that battling and in the maneuvering that it involved, he showed that he had not lost a political step from his days in the legislature. He outflanked a whole bunch of people who thought they had the number of this doddering old fossil. And he was smart like a fox, and he was tough when he had to be, and he was conciliatory in victory. And from the sidelines, it was just a delight to watch. It was just a delight. Stubb amassed what I like to call the punches on his ticket, the milestones in his life, and in a very unassuming fashion. And only when we look back across them now do we see how remarkable they were. At his death, an editorial in the Oregonian suggested that the reader would search in vain to find the CEO of another major company with a similar record of public service. 6 years in the legislature, 30 years on the State Parks Commission, much of the time as its chairman, and 7 very hard years on the State Board of Higher Education in one of the most tempestuous times in the state system's history, all while running one of Oregon's largest companies. Many of us in this room knew Stubb in one dimension or another. Probably none of us knew him in all of his parts, but if Oregon stands for anything, it stands for that kind of citizenship that he demonstrated. It stands for the way that he represented the idea of leaving this place better than you found it. And that, I think, is reason enough for you to pass this resolution.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We have Senator Ferry will be listed, but he hasn't shown up. Do you wish to? I think I have one more. Okay. Is it Brian? Brian Booth? Did you want to testify?
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Brian Booth. I'm originally from Douglas County and now live in Portland. For, I guess, 8 years, I was chair of the Parks Commission, and Stubb was usually right next to me. I can just almost hear him saying now, tell them to move it along. He was an impatient person. He wanted to start on time and get things done. So I will. I have a written statement, but I think I will just talk about his role on state parks. That's the role we were most closely involved for about 15 years. But Stubb was involved with state parks for 30 years before that. I think with the exception of Sam Boardman, the father of state parks, probably no person has had a greater influence on Oregon state parks than Stubb Stewart. And certainly no citizen volunteer has done as much. A 40-year career as a volunteer, effective volunteer for state parks. You know, our park system is one of the great park systems in the world. Oregonians love it. It's a great example of democracy. It's open to everyone. But it's gone from crisis to crisis in the 20th century because when the money is scarce, and money is always scarce, funding decisions usually don't favor state parks, and it's taken great advocacy by volunteers. As head of the State Parks Advisory Committee when Parks was in the Transportation Department, as has been mentioned, Stubb was instrumental in getting the beach bill passed. And it's easy to forget it now, but the beach bill was controversial. Both many influential Republicans and Democrats were opposed to it. It was very tough to get out of committee. Stubb, and I can't call him by his first name, I have to call him Stubb, really led the fight to get the beach bill passed. He helped write the bill, he advocated for it, and he's the single most responsible person, I believe, for getting it passed. And established for all time the public's rights to the dry sand 360 miles of Oregon beaches. In 1989, the legislature moved state parks from the Transportation Department, established the Parks Department. By then, parks had lost its gas tax funding, and there was very little general fund money. I became chair, and Stubb was vice chair. He was in his 80s then. We met every month and probably talked every week. He was a tremendously active co-chair with me. We served under three governors. We dealt with a legislature that wanted to privatize and sell off state parks. We were successful at stopping that. When we couldn't achieve effective stable funding, we proposed the initiative which became Measure 66. Even though it was opposed by much of the political establishment, it passed over 2-1 by the public, and we now have stable funding for state parks and salmon restoration. As has been mentioned, Stubb was a teacher and a mentor. It's often forgotten, or maybe not known, that one of his very first jobs was as a teacher. He mentored a young man after he got out of college and couldn't get a job. First he tried gold mining, and then he became a mentor teaching a young high school age student everything from English to how to hunt and fish. I think Stubb used that education the rest of his life to be a mentor to many, many people. We're fortunate that this forest products leader also became a parks and recreation leader. To Stubb Stewart, issues were not Democratic or Republican or rural or urban. He was motivated by what was good for our state and its people, and he was not afraid to let anyone from senators and governors on down to know his views. One thing that I admire about Stubb in parks, I'm sure other areas, he dealt not just with the administrators. He knew the rangers. He knew the secretaries. He knew the assistants. He loved people, and he knew people from and worked with them from all walks of life. Oregon, at Oregon State Parks, we're lucky and blessed to have Stubb devote so much of his time, energies, and wisdom to the betterment of his state. And the Parks Commission and the Parks Department are pleased to see the Legislative Assembly consider this action, and we urge passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Any questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else here that wants to testify in this House Concurrent Resolution? Representative Hanna, do you wish to say any more? Sounds like a great tribute to a great man, so I'm very pleased. And we'll move it on. We'll move it along. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 10, and I'll open the work session on House Concurrent Resolution 10. Representative Roblin, would you like to make the motion?
I would be glad to.
Just to move it to the...
I would move that we move House Concurrent Resolution 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
It'll be adopted.
We have a motion from Representative Roblin to move House Concurrent Resolution number 10 with a due pass recommendation be adopted to the floor. Do I have any discussion? Would the members like to make any comments? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Burley?
Excuse.
Representative Hass?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Sumner?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. We move House Concurrent Resolution number 10 to the floor to be adopted, and I'll have Representative Hanna as the carrier. And thank you so much for coming today and testifying. What a great memorial. Okay. I think we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2909, and Representative Barnhart is here in the building, in the room. Hard to follow that, isn't it?
It certainly is, ma'am. For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm State Representative from House District 11 from Central Lane and Linn Counties. If I may, just for a moment, add a comment. I knew Stubb Stewart well in his later years. He was a happy man who was also sharp as a whip, and extremely pleasant to be around. You saw me smiling at the testimony that was given earlier because it reminded me of how much I enjoyed his company over many great lunch times at the Town Club in Eugene.
Sounds like many people enjoyed him.
Yes, we certainly did, and I thank you for allowing me to make that comment.
Sure.
Off the point of this bill.
Okay.
House Bill 2909, the primary point of this bill is to improve the efficiency of the process of choosing directors of soil and water conservation districts by removing open positions for which there is no qualified candidate from the ballot and granting the authority to soil and water conservation district boards to fill those positions. There actually are two points to the bill, and that's the first one, and I'll talk about the other one in a minute. It is unfortunately fairly common for there to be no qualified candidates for positions on soil and water conservation district boards, leaving open positions on the ballot. In order to serve on one of these boards, you have to own land in a certain area within the district. It has to be a certain amount of land, and as I understand, it has to be used for certain kinds of purposes. So not just anybody is eligible, even though they may live in the district, to serve on the board. So that the normal process in which you would put an open position up, like a city council position or something of that sort, up on the ballot and then expect write-ins to fill the job, just does not seem to work in the context of these boards, since most of the voters in the district are not actually eligible to serve on the board. These positions often draw thousands of write-in votes. In 2004, why am I a century off today, there were 9,000 write-in votes in the East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District alone. Now, if you think about it, we're using Scantron ballots in Lane County now, as I think it's being used in most of the state. Every single one of these ballots in which there's a write-in has to be handled, taken by hand, and processed specially. There were 9,000 write-ins for these positions. The vast majority, and in fact, I believe the position wasn't filled because the people whose names were written in were not eligible to fill the position. The cost of handling all those ballots and by hand in a special way was around $11,000 for the county clerk's staff. The second purpose of House Bill 2909 is to address a flaw in the current system for special districts that are asking for permanent rate limits by allowing them to defer the cost of attempting to levy permanent rate limits when those levies fail. The change that this bill proposes would allow special districts that currently cannot afford to put levies on the ballot to do so. Special districts will be required to pay the cost of adding successful levies to the ballot. This change will likely increase rather than decrease the portion of the cost of a county election that will be covered by special districts because they'll be more likely to put permanent rate limits on the ballot and thus pay some portion of the election costs when those levies succeed. Because the Oregon Constitution only allows entities to ask for permanent rate limits if they have never before levied a tax, this change would only apply to special districts with no existing tax base. So as a point of clarification, I would note that in Section 7, subsection 4, in which the word district is used, this is an issue that's come up, and I think you may hear about it further, if I want to mention it now. The word district is used, but it's used in the context of the chapter in which district is defined as a soil and water conservation district. So it does not apply to other kinds of districts. Now, there are two amendments, one of which is still in Legislative Council, the -1 amendments, which I think the administrator at least has, is intended to clean up some of the bill's language in order to accomplish our intent to authorize soil and water conservation boards to fill open positions when no qualified candidate has filed for election. The second amendment, which is still in at Legislative Council, would amend Section 7, Subsection 4, by changing the requirements that counties cover the entire cost of the election when the Soil, Water, and Conservation District attempts to levy a permanent rate limit in general elections and fails, and would instead equitably distribute the cost across the county and all other special districts involved at the election time. Now, I want to just make a couple more comments about this, because you may hear about this from other people. We believe that the incremental cost of adding a district levy election to a ballot, which already has a number of other things on it, which is why we limit it to this kind of an election, is nominal. Maybe nothing, maybe zero. The incremental cost, the difference between what the ballot would cost without this item and the amount that it costs with this item. Under the normal rules, it would be required for the district to pay its proportional share of the cost of the election. That results in the failure of the district to actually place a permanent rate limit election or on the election ballot because they have no tax base now and no way of raising funds to pay for the election in the event they lose. This would allow them to place a measure on the ballot for election. The actual incremental cost for the county and the other districts that may have measures on the ballot at that election is nominal, if anything. And in the event, therefore, that the measure fails, the district pays nothing. The others share the costs. In the event that the measure passes, the district shares its fair share of the cost of the election, thus reducing the costs attributable to the other entities, the county and the other special districts. And I hope that's clear. It took a while for me to wrap my head around that idea. And that concludes my remarks, unless there are some questions. And I know there are other people here who understand the details of these issues a lot better than I do.
Any questions, Representative Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I'm curious if you know, but I'm just, how does this impact what, if you put the levy on the ballot, it passes, how does compression come into the tax compression come into the whole series? It's, educate me if you know, because fresh memory and revenue. Does it play an impact, or is this a new levy that's outside of it? Does it change the model, or you don't know?
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist, you know, I haven't actually thought about this question. I understand the point you're making. In the event that this is a property tax levy, frankly, I don't know whether it is or not. Mm-hmm. If it is a property tax levy, then compression is a possibility because, of course, it competes with all other governmental levies in the property tax, and that is a factual question based on the issue, based on the current utilization of the property tax for governmental purposes in the district where the water where the Soil and Water Conservation District exists, in the area where it exists. It might be compression in some parts of the district and not in others. Now, if in fact the levy is something other than a property tax, then this would not apply, and I suspect that some of the people behind me who are here to testify can actually answer that question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's why I raised it. I see the county sitting back there. I think, well, they're going to come up talking about compression, and so I'm
right.
trying to graph
to give
your
question.
Opinion.
Yeah, and I think it is a good question. I would say this, that if the if it applies in the rural parts of the county where the districts actually do their work, then I think it's less likely to cause compression than if it applies in the cities as well, because those are the places where you get one levy stacked on top of another and you hit that 10 mils very quickly.
Thank you. And when do you anticipate the other amendments coming?
We've asked for them right away. We know the committee's ready for them.
Okay.
We've had one version of them come back. We didn't like that, so we're trying again.
Okay.
Turns out it was not only complicated for me to get my head around it, but also for legislative counsel.
Okay, well, we're not going to move this bill today. We'll wait for those amendments. I'd rather do them here.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I have Paul Reed. How do you say that? Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and other members of the Ag Committee. My name is Paul Reed. I'm a director with East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District. I have submitted a whole series of factual items that the clerk is distributing around, and I won't even bother to cover those. Just a couple of other comments. As Representative Barnhart said, there's essentially two components to this bill, but surprisingly, there's an interrelationship between these two components. One of the challenges that soil and water conservation districts have in filling zone director positions is that there is an assumption and written in the statute that the persons that would qualify for these positions are involved in agriculture. Well, I don't need to tell this committee how difficult it is for people in agriculture to make their own payroll. So to ask somebody to volunteer for an unpaid director position with the Soil and Water Conservation District to take on the financial challenges of meeting all of the mandated requirements for soil and water conservation districts without any level of stable funding for conservation districts is, quite frankly, a challenge that a lot of people aren't willing to take on. And so we found that in, I think, this last election, there was 20 districts in the state out of 45 districts that had at least one open position. So the element of the county having to spend a lot of money writing write-in or counting write-in ballots is a very real problem across the entire state. It's not just isolated to one. So removing the impediment to soil and water conservation districts to gain local financial support through an ad valorem tax is one way of eliminating this challenge that the directors of the boards would have to deal with. it also quite honestly would tend to bring a lot of very interested people, because when you start administering local property taxes, it's amazing how many people all of a sudden want to have their say in what's going on. In response to Representative Boquist's question, I would suggest that it's a very local issue, dependent upon how many districts that you have that are in the that are sharing in the $10 per thousand of assessed valuation for non-school activities. I know when in 2002, we at East Lane were anticipating putting a an item on the ballot. Or was it 2000? My memory is not that accurate. But anyhow, I checked with the Lane County Assessor's Office and learned that in Lane County there would not be a compression problem, because what conservation districts are asking for is usually 10 cents or less per thousand of assessed valuation. There's no need for conservation districts to raise tremendous amounts of money. Sums of less than $1 million is more than adequate to fund conservation districts, and usually, like Benton County, just went for a nickel. So the compression problem is not going to be significantly impacted by this element. I was just listening to NPR on the way up today and discovered that there is a new report that has been commissioned called the Millennium Assessment. You may have heard of it. If not, you will be hearing of it in the next couple of days. It was a panel of 100 noted scientists from around the world who were charged with the responsibility of doing a scientific assessment of the environment to discover whether this world can actually support the population that is predicted for the 21st century. And one of the central findings of that body, the report should be released today, I believe, was that healthy ecosystems are essential for the human survival in the 21st century. Now, ultimately, this legislature is going to have to come to grips with the question of what do we need to do to improve and enhance and protect our environment, our ecological base. So the state is, to me, it seems like the state essentially has two choices. One is they can either find a way to fund protection of our natural resources and our ecology from state resources, which I don't need to tell anybody here how difficult that challenge would be, or secondly, to give those organizations like Soil and Water Conservation Districts, who have local responsibilities, local authorities, and local mandates to deal with natural resource conservation, restoration, and preservation initiatives, the ability to gain local support for local actions. The preference that we would have would be to remove the impediment that is contained in existing statutory language that charges special districts with the responsibility of paying for election costs. In the information that the clerk passed out, you'll note in there that even cities don't have to pay for the cost of election for them unless they ask for a special election. However, special districts have a responsibility to pay for the cost of the election. And I would submit, and it's not anything that we're trying to address in this bill, but ultimately it needs to be addressed, that the process that was charged in ORS 255-305 gives the Secretary of State the responsibility of developing an allocation formula. As Representative Barnhart stated, that cost is incremental and should be very little. I mean, we're talking about one more line item on a ballot, and you run it through a machine. How much can it cost to do that? But the process and the allocation formula that the Secretary of State has produces some very large numbers. The reason that we at East Lane didn't choose to go on the tax or to go for a tax-based election in the last general election, not this one but the previous one, was that the estimate from Lane County was that we were going to have to pay somewhere between $50,000 and $60,000 for election costs. As an example of how that can get distorted, Washington County just got a bill, or Tualatin Soil and Water Conservation District just got a bill from Washington County for $78,000 for the for their tax base election that was on the last ballot. Now, that's an unrealistic number as far as I'm concerned, but that's the current allocation formula. Those are the kinds of challenges that Soil and Water Conservation District boards have. I, as a member of an elected body, cannot go forward with an affirmative vote to go for a tax base election when I know we don't have the money to pay for it. I can't incur an indebtedness to our special district that we don't have the ability to pay. And since all of our money comes from grants and is dedicated money, we don't have any discretionary funds to pay for it. So in summary, if we're going to move forward with local actions to protect and restore our environment, we need to have the financial ability to do it, and that comes from removing this impediment to us gaining local financial support.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know, off the top of your head, the 45 conservation districts, how many do or do not have taxing?
I think that there are five at this time. I think Wasco just got it. Benton just got it. I know that Yamhill has had it for quite some time. And, in fact, Yamhill, I think, has the unfortunate circumstance of having it before before ballot measure 50 put a cap on what they could do. So they're in a little bit of a bind. But East Multnomah just got it. And Marion County has it. And Polk has it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So then there's 40 that do not, roughly 40?
Approximately, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Why don't I call John McDonald up? He's the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts Director. Do I have that right?
Yes.
I thought maybe you could answer some of these questions.
I will try. Sure.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Chair Smith and members of the committee. It is a pleasure to speak to this issue. It is not a pleasure to announce that I happen to be chairman of the Tualatin Soil and Water Conservation District that now owes the $78,000. Not having discretionary funds, believe it or not, it falls upon the personal liability of the directors. We are personally liable, and so we're sitting around the room saying, okay, who had a good crop year and who can contribute to the fund this year? Of course, we're meeting with the county commissioners to try to do that, to try to write out maybe an agreeable payment plan. We understand it is a debt that they have billed us for, and we owe it. We knew that going in. We were also quite confident, based upon all the impressions that we had had to canvassing and including the county commissioners themselves, saying, hey, we really want you to have this. We want you to be providing the services, et cetera, et cetera. Please go for it. We were hesitant. We finally were convinced. We lost. Now we've got to come up with a problem, solve the problem. In answer to the questions before, there are six districts that have permanent rate limits. Therefore, 39 do not. Some of the issues of this bill deal with what I would call internal housekeeping, definitions of vacancies, when a vacancy becomes available, when can the department declare a vacancy so that the district can go ahead and fill that position by appointments. I would also like to clarify maybe a little bit of a misimpression that might have been given by the representative introducing the bill, and that is there are ways for any resident of voting age to to run for an office on the district board. At every single district, whether you have seven members or five members on the board, at least two of those are at large, which can be anyone who is a resident and registered voter. We also have mechanisms that we set up recently in the last several years called an associate director position, that if a person does not qualify for a zone position but wants to run for a zone position, they can be appointed as an associate director for 1 year for the district, have a conservation plan that is, frankly, could be anything like, you know, how am I treating the grass in my backyard and trying to attract butterflies? And if they did so for a year, they would be eligible to be appointed to a zone position as well as an at-large position. So we've tried to make this as open as possible and still maintain some kind of a zonal balance, representation, at the same time some type of experience of how to manage land and what kinds of things go into that. So we get a balance of urban interests and rural interests. We get a balance of land managers and maybe businessmen and stuff like that. And I think that's a healthy operation to have. Two things that I want to say are in the testimony, and I'm not going to read the testimony because it's quite long. Three things. One is we have found, and my background before I came back into Oregon was as an organizational consultant. I studied businesses and organizations and found out what made them effective, and I have found other people say the same thing. There are three things that are always true. One is a good, sound vision of knowing where you're trying to go. A second is good, strong leadership to help guide you to do the kinds of things to get to your vision. And the third is a strong, safe, stable financial position from which to operate. We're working like Dickens, you know, defining work plans and business plans and so forth to get the first started. We're providing all kinds of training and upgrading and what we call capacity building and raising the bar and so forth on expectations about competencies and so forth to have the better leadership. What we lack, if we want to stand our stool up of three legs, is we lack the third leg. A couple of them have it, a couple of them don't. Now, the other two things I want to say are going to be unusual because I'm going to look at this as a businessman, not as a politician or not as an elected official. I see the two major things in this bill. One is to not have to put on the ballot a position for which there is no filed candidate, and therefore saving the county money and so forth. I see that as win-win, frankly. Yes, it will save the county money, and you'll hear some figures anywhere from $11,000 to $40,000 of what it costs to do that. It is also, frankly, in my opinion, and I'll just speak for myself, it's a little, shall we say, unsettling to find out that we don't have people who are interested in running for the boards because they don't see the value of what we're doing, or we don't have the resources to, you know, make enough of an impact that people want to join or something like that. So not having all those write-ins and the, frankly, the hassle it goes through and the feelings from the county about, you know, why do you do this to us, it makes us feel bad too. So I think it's a win for us too. We look better if we can appoint our own people and keep full boards that way, which we do routinely throughout the year, obviously. That's something that comes up regularly when a position needs to be filled. The second thing, however, is also a win-win. And that is, there is a direct proportional relationship between what the counties are doing who have a permanent rate limit and therefore maybe a higher budget and so forth in some of the neighboring counties and districts because they have this money. Several things happen. One is they're able to hire more technical people, so they provide more technical services. Two, they begin to focus on more internal issues and priorities because they, like everybody else, follow the money. And if the local tax people are helping provide the money that supports them, then they owe to those local people more focus on what their attention, you know, what their needs are, rather than if your money came from a federal agency or even a state agency, you're going to do what those monies tell you to do, and that's it. If you don't have anything left over to do something else, you're locked in. So, and we're seeing a lot of attention. We're seeing services going to counties that were never there before. Services going to urban residents that they didn't get around to before because they didn't have the staff and they didn't have the funding. Leveraging money. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but districts are central to leveraging about $70 million of federal money into Oregon every year. And we're directly responsible for bringing some of that in here. Not all of it. We work with NRCS, and they do a part, and their lesser part, and ours getting to be a bigger part. So, you know, for the county to say, okay, we're going to waive the amount that we could have charged you as an election fee, and if it happens to pass, what we're seeing is, over the couple years that follow, a change in attitude, a change in focus, direction, services, level of services, type of customer, ability to leverage, and ability to work with a broader range of landowners, including county departments. And I think the county, frankly, wins. I think they put an investment into something that pays off for them. And I'd like to see us look at how we can see this, not as, you want some of our money, or we're not going to let you have that, or we're going to fight against this, and trying to split the thing apart, but to say, here's the county, the commissioners make the decisions about the budgets, the elections people do the work, here are the districts, we have an elected board, unpaid, we're a service organization, we don't charge fees, and stuff like that. We can help the county can help us. And I think if we look at it that way, from a business long-range approach, and not in some little isolated myopic this year, this time, I think we've got a better chance of actually seeing what the opportunities are. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Paul Ian Rain. I hope I said that right. Hi.
I'm going to try not to read my entire statement because you're going to get a copy of it. I'm Ian Rains. I'm the district administrator for the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, which is all of Multnomah County east of the Willamette River. Our board supports this bill on both counts, the write-in vote question and the property tax election cost question. I'll let you read my testimony at your convenience. Let me focus a little bit about the property tax part. And can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Okay. Our district, the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, put a property tax measure on the ballot this fall and passed. We talked with the county elections office before the election, before the board decided whether or not we were going to go for a property tax rate. And they said that they weren't going to bill us if the thing lost, if it failed. So we went ahead and put the ballot measure on the ballot, even though we weren't sure how it would do. And luckily it passed, and we don't have to worry about paying election costs had it failed. We're going to be able to, it's a 10 cents per thousand. So if somebody had a $100,000 home, it's $10 a year. $200,000 property is $20 a year. It's not a lot of tax. And in answer to the question on compression, most of the properties, it's kind of a property by property thing, depending on which fire district and whatever districts they have. And most of the properties in our district will not be under compression. And so our 10 cents isn't going to, it's going to raise their taxes a little bit and not take away money from other folks. Had the properties where it would be compression, we'll just get a piece of the existing pie. But in most of the properties, the pie gets a little bit bigger and we have a little piece and all the other districts have their piece. We're going to be able to increase our staff not only by adding a few staff positions that we need to have, including a district manager position that will supervise staff and do a better job of policy development and that kind of thing that we haven't been able to put our attention on, but also bring some staff up to full-time who have been had to cut back to part-time because of budgeting issues. We've been highly dependent on grants, which are one-year or two-year grants from OWEB and DEQ and other places, and also Oregon Department of Agriculture funds, and also Multnomah County general funds of about $28,000 per year for the last 5 years. It's gone from $36,000 down to $19,000, but it's averaged $28,000. We're not going to ask for that money anymore from Multnomah County, because frankly, we have quite a bit more than that coming in on the property tax, so we don't need to have that. We'll be able to increase staff salaries and have a benefits package, which we haven't currently had. Currently, we just have very basic health insurance, but no other benefits, no retirement, no vision, no dental, any of that kind of stuff. So we'll be able to recruit professional qualified staff and retain those staff and our current staff who've had to look around for other jobs because districts typically don't pay very much. people work for conservation districts because they love the work and they believe in natural resource conservation and agriculture production and whatever kind of things that they're here for. But we tend to, oftentimes districts lose people after they've been trained on how to be a conservation planner, then they go off and work someplace else where they can make a living. So the kinds of things we'll be able to do will be greatly increase our programs and services for our constituents. We're adding a program element. We're adding another program. We're expanding on the programs that we currently have. So the services and the programs will be in a much better position to not only help our constituents, but help the county departments or other partners in the community that we've worked with for a long time. We've had a good relationship, and now we'll be able to provide some additional technical and professional assistance and possibly administrative grant writing assistance and that kind of stuff. So it's having the tax rate is going to be very helpful. And if we had had to worry about paying the cost, we wouldn't have gone for it. So the county would not be seeing the leveraging of funds that John talked about, the kind of increased programs and services a couple of us had talked about, a greater degree of self-sufficiency of the conservation district, and a lot more conservation being done on the ground than what we've ever been able to do before in 54 years of the district. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Any questions, Ms. Rains? No, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Great, good job. Paul Snyder? I have Jan Coleman. Are you guys, do you want to come up together? I have you on the same line here, so. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I'd like to begin with a couple of things. We have not taken a position yet on House Bill 2909, but we do have an ongoing concern about unfunded mandates. And it's one that we would like to address as well as possible and still accomplish some of the goals that the proponents have suggested are important. My understanding is, and Ms. Coleman could address this is more specifically, that the Clerks Association and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts worked together along with the Department of Agriculture to develop the first part of the legislation. And I think the previous speakers are correct that it creates a win-win situation for everybody. It's an improvement. With respect to the second piece of the bill about what do you do in the case of a levy that fails, I had gone through the legislation as it currently is printed, and it appeared to me that we were talking about the creation of a new taxing entity in the form of a Soil and Water Conservation District at a general election, where it also involves the creation of a tax base. All three of those things would occur at the same election. If that's correct, if my reading of the legislation is correct, then the fiscal impact on counties is not terribly great, because there are offsetting things in the bill that would create some savings. And I've looked to the county clerks. This is a new issue for me, and I'm learning as I go. But if that's the case, then it's not too onerous an issue. And if Representative Barnhart's intent is what it sounded to me as though it was, and that is to spread equitably among all taxing districts, because in the event that at that election where all three of those things are present at the same time and the levy fails, that would be spread among all taxing districts within the county, then that would reduce further the fiscal impact on the counties, if I understand it correctly. And I'd really like to take a look at the -3 amendments when they're done to see if that's the case.
Will you be able to come back when we have those? Or
yes. Okay. Yes, Madam Chair. I'd be pleased to do that. But there is some value, I think. One of the issues that we've had to work through over and over in many different contexts is to couple the ability to control outcomes with the responsibility for the outcomes. It's one of those things that makes government work better, frankly. And I think there is some value to be given to the situation where if you're going to seek an election, you're going to go for a tax base, you have control over what you're going to ask the voters to do, that there should also be some responsibility for an unfavorable outcome. It just makes the process work better. It gets people more focused on what they're asking the voters to do, and it makes them more intense in advancing their case to the voters. Now, I don't know how that fits in the context of this situation, but I think I've had a little bit of concern about there seem to be a number of people where they have vacancies and where nobody runs for the office, and that's the gist basically of the first half of the bill. And if we could develop an interest on the part of the voters by identifying what the issues are that you're asking them to vote on, I think that improves the process and makes more informed voters and better outcomes as well. But with respect to the fiscal issue, which is really the primary one that we have, I agree that the first part of the bill is a win-win, and the clerks can be more certain in that than I. With respect to the second part of the bill, if we can minimize the fiscal impact, then that would minimize the concerns the counties have.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Any questions? No. Go ahead, Ms. Coleman.
Good morning, Chair Smith and other representatives. I'm Jan Coleman. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk. I come from that district that actually I've been in the office for 22 years, and that district had a base when I came into the office. So they've had it for a long time in that district. I would speak to the fact that Paul addressed that, yes, the first part of the bill is definitely a win-win. In the 2004 general election in Multnomah County, they spent $20,000 extracting all the write-in names for unfiled positions. They had two different parts of two different soil and water districts, and they had three no candidate filed positions. So the extracting of those votes cost them $20,040. After all was said and done, none of those three write-in who won the majority of the votes for those write-ins qualified to hold the offices. So it's a very frustrating thing out there, not only for us who do the work, but for the district too. My district is very proactive as far as getting candidates to file. I do not have the impact that this has had. In years past, there has been some. But, you know, it does depend on the district how proactive they are to get the candidates to file. And having been married to a farmer, I know that they can't be bothered to do things like that. So, you know.
It's difficult.
Yeah. There is definitely, you know, a fiscal advantage to the counties for that part of it. I, like Paul, we conferred about the second part of the bill that we have seen, and we have some concern. If we understand it to be as he described, then we think there will be minimal fiscal impact, but we do definitely want to see the B version here.
I think we do too.
Yeah,
as a committee.
So we're kind of reserving our position until we see exactly how it's written.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, Representative Oakley?
Yes, Madam Chair. First, does anything get that over? Yeah, I know you're over here more now.
I know it.
I'm beginning to wonder. I'm a little concerned. A couple pragmatic questions, if you'll entertain me, Madam Chair. If we take it off the ballot, which I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
The question is how do we still have some sort of public contact to say, hey, folks out there, we need volunteers to help here. Do we put something in the voter's pamphlet that says no one files, so it's not on the ballot, but if you're interested, call 1-800 soil and water. Because we experienced this problem, you know, in Tillamook and elsewhere.
Sure.
Finding members. Because we, one of the advantages of having on the ballot is somebody realizes that there is a vacancy, like, oh, maybe I should do some service and I qualify. But so yeah, we should take it off the ballot in my mind to save it, but somehow we still need to reach those people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing comes back to, I guess, when the Third Amendment comes, is would be what is the discussion in regards to, you don't want to just keep putting it on the ballot. Have you guys thought about some sort of mechanism that gets the Soil and Water District in a position where they I don't know, maybe pay something or there's something so they just don't keep throwing it up on the ballot time and time and time again? Some sort of accountability mechanism, but isn't onerous.
They're basically, we're kind of limited by the law in how that comes about, and the process they described here is pretty much how it happens. If you're an established district and you present things, then you just share in the pie. But in order, and before you are established, this is the mechanism, this is how it works. And that's all in the statute.
Yeah. What's wrong? Yeah. We're fixing to vote on whether we're going to change the statute, I guess, is
right.
My point. And
yeah.
So, and I think, Paul, if you look at it, you know, you either come to a consensus or agreement or some mechanism that might cover those points.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Boquist kind of took my question away, but I was about to suggest that water and soil conservation districts should take on the responsibility, possibly, of recruiting qualified applicants. It is a nonpartisan position. Making sure that somebody signs up to get on that ballot to save the taxpayers $20,000 or more dollars sorting out unqualified applicants. I think a little bit of preemptive action would be in order. Thank you.
Thank you. In other words, lie to them about the responsibility of being on a board.
Exactly. much the same way city councils, libraries.
I know.
You know.
I think we all face the same problem to get people to do these jobs. And duly noted. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
just a quick comment. Thank you. Not to be argumentative, yeah. But my guess is that these organizations are doing everything they can to recruit candidates. And if they're not, shame on them. But I would think they are at least making a good effort to do that.
And I think that goes without saying, too. But good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I might add that part of the formation of a district and a tax base for regular districts, and that's how it comes about, and they're proposing to add this part into their ORS. The actual one comes from 198. So they're, you know, that's the one, but they're looking to add this part into their ORS so that it would be just limiting to their soil and water districts.
Right.
So that's where the difference is.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, both of you. And I'm sure you'll be back.
I have Larry from the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I apologize for not being able to say your last name. Maybe you can inform. It's not me beeping.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Larry Oyua. I'm the program manager for the Soil and Water Conservation Districts with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and thank you all for the opportunity to address House Bill 2909. Try to go through this quickly. We support the three concepts in the bill, the issue of clarifying the vacancies and getting all the vacancy rules in Chapter 568, which is an enabling chapter for districts, and reducing the count of the cost of the county elections officials for the writing, the count, and votes. I brought with me, I didn't bring up to the front, a stack of papers from East Lane District for the write-ins. And it is a significant cost. We recognize that. We're the filing officer, the department's the filing officer for the Conservation District Director positions, which means we work with the districts to put out the public notice, collect the nomination forms, and submit the names to the county elections officials. And we are very appreciative of the work that they do. Often the work that they do is not recognized, and they do a great job, and we've had a very good working relationship with them. The third part of this bill, in regards to the permanent tax rate limits, we support any kind of effort we can do to get districts to have a better chance of getting a permanent rate on the ballot, but we're sensitive to the unfunded mandate issue, and our hope, that we've been working with the conservation districts and OACD and talked with Annette Newingham from Lane County back in 2002. Our hope was that some of the costs that could be saved by this part, one part of the bill, could offset the possible costs in the event that a permanent rate limit would fail. So that was our hope. History has shown us, and it's been mentioned by other people, that the districts with permanent rates really do contribute a lot to the conservation efforts and some of the state programs like the Ag Water Quality Management Programs, Senate Bill 1010, the Oregon Plan for Water, Salmon and Watershed. So for us at the department, the districts that have a permanent rate, we see very good things and lots of leveraging of local funds and state funds and federal funds with the work that they do. The department would be interested in being involved in conversation when the other amendments come out. We would like to see a win-win situation with this thing that would address the concerns of the county clerks, but also address the issue of the permanent rates. And I'll leave it at that if you have questions.
Thank you very much. I think you answered them. Thank you very much. And the last one I have is Allison Hensley from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Hello.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Allison Hensley. I'm with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 2909. My comments are brief, and they relate specifically to Section 7 of the bill regarding election costs. Soil and water conservation districts are important partners for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board in implementation of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. They help local communities improve water quality and fish habitat, as well as helping agricultural landowners with their operations. OWEB supports stable funding sources for all of its partners. It just helps them do a better job in providing services to their local community. I know that federal funding for soil and water conservation districts has been significantly curtailed in the last decade, which has caused a hardship for districts, and that one of the most reliable long-term funding sources for districts is getting a local tax base. I understand that potential election costs are a significant barrier to some districts seeking that tax base, and OWEB supports a solution for minimizing that barrier or removing that barrier that everybody involved agrees to. I understand that there is a fiscal impact on counties from this kind of solution, and so I would just like to offer that OWEB would be happy to be part of a discussion about how to minimize that barrier in a way that has consensus of everybody involved.
Great. Thank you, Allison. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're at the end of the testimony, and I think what we'll do is just wait until we get the Dash 3 amendments, and Representative Barnhart can be in touch with all the parties interested in working on this, and maybe we can come to a solution on this and move that bill. So I'll close the House public hearing on House Bill 2904. You have to be on the floor at 11, so hopefully. House Bill 29, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2926. And Patrick, do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Madam Chair, House Bill 2926 deletes provisions in statute allowing 10 landowners in a soil and water conservation district from forcing a referendum on consolidation of a district with another soil and water conservation district. There's no fiscal or revenue impact to the measure.
So it goes straight to the floor.
It would go straight to the floor.
Okay. Thank you. John McDonald, would you like to come up? Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Smith and members of the committee, thank you again. My name is John McDonald. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I before mentioned myself as the chair of the Tualatin Soil and Water Conservation District, and I happen to be a hazelnut grower, so I get to see it from all sides. thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. This is, in our position, kind of a no-brainer type of thing. Current situation, six counties have two or more conservation districts in those counties, and they would be the ones that would be most likely possibly to consolidate at some time, given circumstances being correct. But the consolidation applies to anybody. I mean, any of the districts that are contiguous to each other could even combine into a two-county district or something like that. So it applies across the board. Right now, there are two ways to do that. One is by petition of 25 or more landowners who apply to the Department of Agriculture for a ruling that this is okay, or by resolution of the two district boards, and it comes up before a hearing. The difficulty is that if at that hearing 10 people object to the consolidation, then it forces a referendum. And the referendum in some of the places, could be a little expensive. We have looked back through all the legislature. We've looked back through the times in 1965 and 1981 when this particular section was amended. Believe it or not, the 10% and the 10 individuals were there from 1939. So it was obviously at a time, hasn't been amended since, even though they had two opportunities to do it. We just think that the 10 is just an unreasonably low figure, because you can go anywhere and find 10 people who want to object to anything. And that it could be, therefore, maybe even an artificial kind of objection that would force a referendum that the Department of Agriculture would have to pay for. Could be expensive. They don't have it in their budgets. And it doesn't really represent a valid protest to something as significant as combining two districts. Therefore, we're asking that that particular provision be stricken from the law, and that we would be left with the 10% of landowners would have to file some kind of written protest saying we want this to go to a referendum of the people before it would be acted upon. I think that that's a little more reasonable. It causes a little more serious concern as to why the objections would be, rather than just 10 individuals.
So this bill would take out the 10 individuals, and you'd still have the 10%
correct
landowners in that.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and the only technical thing I had, and I think I discussed it with Mr. Brandon, was we weren't sure whether the word at least 10 should be there, so it didn't necessarily, with some legal picky person, say it had to be at exactly 10%. I don't know how the law is supposed to read on those things, but we assumed it would be at least 10%. So
we get into many discussions down here over exactly the same.
We're just like that.
Yeah. Any questions of Mr. McDonald? Representative Byer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not being that familiar with soil and water districts, and I'm sure they're all different sizes, but on average, what would a membership be in one of these organizations?
The membership, there are either five or seven directors, as far as elected directors. Staffs can be anywhere from a half-time clerk to 10 full-time people, depending on where you are and what kind of funding you have, and whether you happen to live along the Columbia River and have BPA funding, which has helped. But populations are anywhere from 18,000 in one county to 2.5 million in another. The four, the one that has four districts, believe it or not, is Baker County. It has four separate districts in that county, and I don't know the population of Baker County, but it can't be over $30,000, $50,000, $60,000 people at the most. Some of the other counties that have two are in the 85,000 range, so forth. So they're in Multnomah. Grant County has two. I'm probably going to miss one of them just because I'm trying to pull them off the top of my head. Josephine County has two. Lane County has two. And I'm sure there's another one that I've forgotten, Lake County.
Well, thank you. That kind of helps me because I was assuming we were looking at large numbers, but I just kind of wanted to get an idea.
Well, for example, the consolidation of Monument Soil Water Conservation District and Grant Soil Water Conservation District constitutes the entire county of Grant. I don't happen to know the population, but I think the small corner, northern corner called Monument is a very small population of something like a couple thousand people.
I think it's smaller than it used to be.
Yeah. Correct. Yes, that would be true, Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Larry, we have you listed again, and I didn't get to hear you say your last name because his phone was going off.
That's right. Except for phone.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Larry Oyua.
Oyua.
O-J-U-A. Yeah. I'm with the Department of Agriculture and Program Manager for the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And I'll just take a couple seconds. We concur with John McDonald and the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. Our Conservation Commission, which is an advisory body to the department, has worked with us over the last couple of years on this issue. It is a barrier for the districts that have looked into consolidating, and we just think that the language from 1939 needs to be updated to a reasonable number. So we support this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? I might just call you Larry.
Yeah, that's fine.
Representative Roblin.
To get on the record, as the last person I can ask, you concur then that 10% in this bill means 10% or more of the...
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I'm not an attorney, but I would assume that we meant at least 10%. So, and if we need to... if it's advisable to amend the bill to say at least 10%, that should be looked at.
As long as the intent is clear. Okay. I think we've made that clear.
Very clear. Thank you very much. Seeing no one else, does anyone else want to testify on this bill? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2926, and I'll open the work session on House Bill 2926. Representative Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2926 be sent to the floor and do pass.
My only comment would be, do you think it should be on the consent calendar?
With consent.
With consent. I have a motion from Representative Boquist to move House Bill 2926 to the floor with a due pass and put it on the consent calendar. Do I have any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byers?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Excuse.
Representative
Haas?
Aye.
Representative
Roman?
Aye.
Representative Sumner?
Aye.
Chair Smith?
Chair votes aye. We move House Bill 2926 to the floor and place it on the consent calendar. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2926. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2927. Patrick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2927 allows the Board of Directors for a Soil and Water Conservation District to issue general obligation bonds with, upon receiving approval of a majority of the electors within the district. This measure has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue. And I believe Mr. McDonald will speak to some amendments that will be necessary for the bill.
Thank you very much. John McDonald, would you like to come up? Okay. So you might tell me this. We're not going to move this at all. Thank you and welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, welcome again. Thank you for letting us speak to a third bill in succession. And
it's Soil Conservation of Water Day.
It's a conservation of the tires on my car driving down here, an hour and a half to get here, so I appreciate that as well.
That's
nice. I wanted to explain one thing here that you're getting that probably is unexpected, and that is House Bill 2927, as you would find it up on the web, with downloading it with your PDF file and stuff like that, you would get a certain wording. When the bill came back, and I forget the exact number, when it came back from Legislative Council, it had a particular number. Mm-hmm. At that time, staff in Chair Smith's office sent it to me and said, because you had proposed these bills, we wanted you to take a look at the wording that the Legislative Council came up with and comment on it and possibly send us any ideas you might have if you see any problems. We noticed by comparing the wording that came back from Legislative Council compared to the copies of other such statutes that applied to other special districts that we had given them as examples to follow, mm-hmm. and maybe looking at the kind of wording that we were trying to seek for ourselves, that they had omitted a major portion of it. In other words, a major part of making this a general obligation bond provision was missing in the wording that came back. So we called down to Special Districts Association, as we often do, to confer about what do we do about this. And we needed technical guidance. So they referred us to a gentleman in Portland who referred us to a another person that they work with who is a bond attorney. And this lady, Ann Sherman, who works in a particular firm up there, drafted out the language as to how this bill ought to read. All it does is it makes a few cosmetic changes in the first sections, because what she did was to suggest adding a section 4, which happens to be on this sheet here, which is the second one, suggested amendments. She said without this section 4, you might as well have provisions to go out and, you know, get a loan. It doesn't become a general obligation bond without these particular words. This is what makes it work the way it's supposed to work. And so she suggested that that be done. When I received the report back from Ms. Sherman, I put it in an email and sent it down here. And we have no idea what happened to it, because when I called last night up to the committee administrator's office in 453, I found out there was no amendment for this particular bill. And in talking with Patrick Brennan this morning, he confirmed that we can't find one. We have it. See, well, we don't know where it is.
And Y2K.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah, right. It was, I've got these little transfer things that say it was sent off into the black hole sometime on March the 2nd and never received again.
This suggested amendment will be an amendment to this bill, Dad.
I certainly hope that you, okay. Chair Smith, will accept this and the committee will accept this as an official amendment that you will carry forward to have put into a dash one or however the wording looks, and so that what consideration we have will be with the assumption that, you know, these words will be there.
But we'll probably
do
another work session on this after we get back the proposed language.
Okay. The only request I would make, Chair Smith, is a couple people came to specifically speak to this bill and about the need for it and stuff like that, and I'd like to make a couple comments, and then we can go to a later time. The need, obviously, is for people to be able to do things that they can't do through other sources, particularly in the areas of buildings and renovations of sizable nature and stuff like that. My personal advice would be to a district, don't go after one of these unless you have a permanent rate limit, because obviously the laws are if you gained a general obligation bond, you've excluded yourself from, you know, eligibility for applying for a permanent rate limit at a later date. So this should be applying basically to the six who have permanent rate limits, or anybody who foolishly says they will never have one, and I'd counsel against that, obviously. One of the advantages we found in buildings is that because we work so closely with a lot of other partners, particularly the Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, by putting some of their staff and in Natural Resources Conservation Service and Farm Service Agency and Resource Conservation and Development Councils, and RD, rural development agencies and so forth, and sometimes even staff people from ODA who happen to be in field offices, and et cetera, in the same building, we get a lot of efficiencies and economies. And we've also found out that some of the districts who've chosen to buy or build buildings have been able to rent them out to these other partners at a lower rate than they were having to pay elsewhere, and the districts were end up getting very low rate, if not rent free, as long as they were willing to take on the responsibility of being a landlord, which is one of the implied powers you could get out of our statute and move on. So we think it's an opportunity, and basically it's all we're asking you to do is to grant the districts the authority to be able to ask the local people to do this, and of course it's their decision. Great. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. McDonald? Thank you, and we will submit the proper documentation to get these amendments on here and bring it back.
Okay. And Chair Smith, there are a couple people who came specifically to speak to this, and we're going to rush
Stieber.
Off.
Stieber?
Particularly Tim Stieber, yes.
Yeah, okay.
The honor of him being allowed, thank you.
Oh, yeah, sure. Public hearing. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Smith and committee, for allowing me to speak today. I didn't have a written testimony. I've got some notes here. I was asked yesterday to come down and try to speak to what the Yamhill Soil and Water Conservation District believes about the House Bill 2927. Mm-hmm. My name is Tim Stieber, district manager at that particular district, Yamhill, and we believe that the House bill would enable the soil and water conservation districts the ability to utilize general obligation bonds to complete capital improvement projects, much like other locally led municipalities and districts. Soil and water conservation districts are locally led organizations. We've heard a couple of times that work closely with many partners, such as state and federal departments of ag, watershed councils, local governments. And passage of House Bill 2927 would strengthen that partnership. And one of the things that I've kind of discovered is that very few of these partners are able to actually go out and construct a building. They just don't have that in their charter or mandate. You don't see federal offices being built around in local areas. They might be built in Salem, they might be built in Portland, but they're not built in Yamhill County. And we believe that if we can have the ability to ask the voters for a general obligation bond, we'd be able to ensure that we can keep those partners at that local site and offer competitive rent and really strengthen our partnership. Any questions?
Any questions? Seeing none. You did great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Larry, have you as the last person?
Okay. I'll make it quick. So I'm Chair, members of the committee, Larry Oyewa, Department of Agriculture. Just a couple points. We concur with the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts and the Conservation Commission that this is a tool that should be in the toolbox for conservation districts like other special districts for capital construction. Several districts are looking at building buildings. The option they have right now for, say, Yamhill, Polk, and Marion, those three districts locally here are all looking at ways to build a building. Really, the only option for them right now is to take that out of existing operating funds, which normally is not a very good option when they have a big ticket item like a purchase of a building and land. So we believe that the amendments that John spoke to are needed to clarify that. I've got a copy of those. We support those amendments. Okay. And finally, I just make a point that there's a lot of talk today about the election costs and on general obligation bond costs. I want to make sure you understand that those costs are picked up by the district that sponsors it. So they need to be prepared to do that, and those are the ones that would have permanent rates would be best suited to do that.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. I don't see anybody else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else here who wants to testify on 2927?
Chair Smith, just a question.
Sure.
A general obligation bond issued by Soil and Water, would that come under the double majority rule that exists in Oregon now?
Yes. The way I understand it would.
So it'd be a really tough sell, it sounds like.
I think every general obligation bond is a tough sell. But yeah, the way I understand it, it would, yes.
Okay, thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2927. And committee, we're going to get the amendments back and bring those bills back for further discussion. And I appreciate your patience and time, and thank you to everyone who came today to testify. And with that, I'll close the House Ag and Natural Resource Committee. We are adjourned.